We welcome you again to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm Brent Topp, your host of this program, where we look at important issues and events and people associated with the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We've been talking about some of those great events in upstate New York and Kirtland. We're going to continue today by talking about some very interesting events that take place not only in Kirtland, but later in Nauvoo, and continue to bless all of us as members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. A fascinating story about how we get the Book of Abraham. Today with me is my guest, Professor Brian Hauglett of the Department of Ancient Scripture at Brigham Young University, is one of the great scholars we have in the church on the Book of Abraham. And so, Brian, we're grateful to have you here with us today on our program.
Good to be with you, Brent.
We know historically a little bit that some mummies and some papyri end up in the hands of the prophet Joseph Smith. Why don't you tell us that story and how it comes about?
Well, it actually goes back to Egypt.
Okay.
Back in 1798, when Napoleon went into that area, there was an influx of skilled artisans and scientists and robbers and all sorts of people that came in and started looking and digging and trying to find things. And one of those pursuits, under the direction of a guy named Dravetti, he hired a guy named Antonio Labello and started some work down in the Valley of the Kings, or the valley where there's a bunch of tombs on the west side of the Nile down there.
Where we could say for our listeners where King Tut's tomb
That's
was
right.
found as well.
King Tut's tomb was found in that area. And Antonio Labello is digging and trying to find materials that can go into Dravetti's hand, and I guess he was trying to sell them. A lot of
mm-hmm.
things were sold on the black market back in those days. But in one of the tombs, they found mummies, lots and lots of mummies. And when they went into the inner portion of that tomb and found some of the VIPs, they also found papyri rolls. And 11 mummies were unearthed from that tomb, along with probably several papyri rolls. And those were eventually brought back to Italy. That was Antonio Labello's hometown or home country. And he kept him there. And then in we're talking probably back in the 1816 to 1820 range here. That's when it was discovered. And then later on, they go back to Italy. And then Antonio Labello gets sick and he dies. But before he dies, he had figured out a way to get those 11 mummies and papyri back to the United States, to New York. And that's how they get to New York anyway. And then they get picked up by a man named Michael Chandler. We're not exactly sure when he comes into the picture, actually. Mm-hmm. We know that the mummies and papyri were shown in New York at the Masonic Hall. There's several indications of that with announcements and papers. But Michael Chandler's name's not attached to any of that. So we don't even know when he really picks them up. But we do know that he gets them, and then he sells them along the way while he's showing. He charges people. That's what he did.
For admission to see him.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so he'd charge people, but he would also try to lighten his load, I think, and get rid of one here and get rid of one there. And so by the time he gets into Kirtland, Ohio in 1835, this is in late June or early July of 1835, he's got four mummies.
And we might say that from us today, it might seem kind of weird that you go from New York to Kirtland, Ohio, but I think we have to bring back into context, we've got the Erie Canal.
That's right.
And so that is a major passageway or thoroughfare
right.
to going into the Western Reserve.
That's right. And you have a famous man named Joseph Smith
mm-hmm.
also that I think Michael Chandler's heard about when he was up in New York.
New York. Mm-hmm.
And so you've got both those things kind of coming together. And Michael Chandler being interested, probably maybe more in the money at that point. I think by the time he got to Kirtland in 1835, he's ready to get rid of the whole batch of stuff that he's got. And so he has Joseph Smith contacted. Joseph Smith comes and he's given a couple of days to look at some of the materials. And Joseph Smith is interested in the papyri, just the papyri. And Michael Chandler says, well, it's kind of a package deal here. You can have the papyri if you buy the mummies too. And Joe Smith said, well, I don't really want the mummies. And he said, well, then you can't have the papyri. Mm-hmm. And so it ended up getting sold for $2,400 to three men, Joe Smith, Simon Coe, and I can't remember the other one's name right now. It might not even be Simon Coe, but three men that put $800 together a piece, which, by the way, would be probably $60,000 or $70,000 now.
Yeah, substantial sum.
Exactly. So that was a lot of money for the church to put out for that material. And so, but now it's in the hands of the church at that point. In July of 1835, Joseph Smith owns that material for the church.
Okay. You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. Today with me is Professor Brian Hauglid of the Department of Ancient Scripture at Brigham Young University. And we're talking about how we get the Book of Abraham. Brian, as we now have these papyri rolls, and the mummies as the extra prize for the purchase there in the hands of the prophet Joseph Smith, what do we know about how Joseph realizes there's something of great value in these records?
Well, we have the history of the church, of course, that was part of Joseph Smith's journals. And we know that there was a recording made that says that when Joseph Smith looked at the papyri, he said something like, we discern by revelation, I think it was, something like that, that it's the Book of Abraham and the Book of Joseph.
Hmm.
And so...
That immediately grabs the attention.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it says at this point that Oliver Cowdery and W.W. Phelps were called as scribes to be the scribes for the prophet as he dictated the Book of Abraham.
What do we know about the translation process, and how does it differ from maybe the translation of the Book of Mormon?
Well, that's an excellent question. We have in the historical account only about maybe half a dozen references to translation, and nothing really in July that really just comes out and says it's a translation of the Book of Abraham. You have to understand that at the same time that Joseph Smith is translating the Book of Abraham, he's also interested in Egyptian things.
Mm-hmm.
He's really, and so is W.W. Phelps. They're very interested in learning Egyptian. They're interesting in, I mean, the United States, actually, there's a lot of people that are interested in that kind of thing at that point. And so the translation itself, we have, like I say, about a half a dozen references to it in the historical record, but most of them come out of October, November of 1835, where it says that they're translating the Book of Abraham. Now, that doesn't mean that there was no translation in July or August. It's just that we just don't have
a record of
exactly.
It. Mm-hmm. Well, so as they begin to translate, as you pointed out in our previous episode, as we talked about the Joseph Smith translation, that as these precious morsels from heaven are revealed to the prophet Joseph, I can imagine that the saints were very, very anxious to know what is going on with these ancient Egyptian papyri rolls. How is it made available to the saints, and when is it first published?
Well, it's become clear to me that there were copies made.
Okay.
And I think that Joseph Smith felt it important that when he received revelations from the Lord, that he wanted to make those available to the saints as soon as he could. And so we actually have several copies, in fact, three copies of just the first chapter and a half of the Book of Abraham, which kind of tells us.
So it would be the English translation.
Exactly.
Would we have inscriptions? Would we have hieroglyphs? Would we have anything like that? So when you say that we made copies of it, it's not necessarily a facsimile copy of the papyri, but a translation of what we have.
We're getting mostly the English text there.
Okay.
There are some characters on some of the manuscripts that seem to indicate that there was some correlation to the Egyptian there, but it's generally just English, just the English translation that we're getting, and mostly of the same material.
Mm-hmm.
And now that tells me that Joseph Smith is trying to get it out. He's trying to make it available to other people so that they can see, you know, what this Book of Abraham is.
So they would make copies, the handwritten copies that could then be distributed among the saints.
That's right.
When do we get it actually published as as a text, I guess you would say.
I think Joseph Smith probably wanted to publish it a lot earlier than he did. And again, once you get from 1835, 1836 down till 1840, you've got some serious things going on with the church, financial things, persecutions, apostasies, all sorts of things happening. And so it just doesn't seem like he's ever able to really get to it until they get to Nauvoo.
Okay.
And once he gets to Nauvoo, he gets right on it and hires Willard Richards as a scribe, and they start going through and creating printing copies, those kinds of things, and it gets published beginning in March of 1842 in the Times and Season. It goes in three installments, three very separate installments. The first installment is pretty much the material that we have record of right now, that first chapter and a half. The second installment was the rest of the Book of Abraham from about Abraham 2:19 on to the end. And then the last one is the facsimile number 3. Joseph Smith publishes facsimile number 1 in the first installment. He publishes facsimile 2 in the second installment. And then he publishes facsimile number 3 alone without any other Book of Abraham in that third one. But later on, he says, in the Times and Season, he says a notice. He says, I'm going to make more of the Book of Abraham available as time permits. Mm. But it was never happened.
Mm. Interesting. Well, what happened to the traveling mummy show?
Well, the mummies, we're not exactly sure what happened to them. The actual collection, after the prophet is martyred, goes into the hands of his mother. And Lucy has it for a while, a couple of years, and then, of course, she passes away, and then it goes to Emma. And then
maybe even before we get Lucy Maxsmith onto the spirit world, we could say that there was kind of an amusement to
even
in Nauvoo as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
So even though Michael Chandler had done it to the saints do much the same thing,
Lucy,
because there's incredible interest for it.
Lucy, I don't think, had a lot of money either. Mm-hmm. And so she would actually charge people to come in and see the material. After Joseph died, and of course Samuel died uh-huh. too, and in Hiram, she lost three sons in that little time period. And of course her husband has been gone for years. I think she uses it kind of as a help.
Yeah.
And so, but the mummies themselves, we know where basically two of them went. And then we don't know what happened to the other two, because the collection gets split up. Part of it goes off to the museum in Chicago, and that burns up in 1870s.
Well, and then, we're going to come back and talk about the significance of that
all right,
as well.
But we can do that.
So where the other two come from?
Well, we think that one of the ones that Chandler had anyway is up in the University of Pennsylvania. The head of it is up there. And then we have another scholar that maybe has identified one other up in Canada somewhere.
Interesting.
And so, but that's kind of, on the edge of the research there. So
interesting. You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. I'm talking with Professor Brian Hauglett of Ancient Scripture at Brigham Young University. We've been talking about the Egyptian papyri and the origins of the Book of Abraham. Brian, why don't you tell us more about the papyri? We've talked a little bit about the mummies. We've talked a little bit about Joseph's interest in the papyri and the translation. What do we know about what the papyri look like? What do people tell us about those papyri rolls that make their way to Nauvoo from Kirtland?
Well, the papyri that Joseph Smith had in his possession anyway was a lot more than what we have now. But we have some eyewitness accounts from his period talking about the Book of Abraham being translated from a long roll. Now we know that the papyri was in what's called hieratic. So it wasn't in actual hieroglyphs. Those are much older. And so it's a little bit newer Egyptian, which is called hieratic. And the material that Joseph Smith had, if he's got that long roll and the Book of Abraham's on that, well, we don't have that anymore. But we do have eyewitness accounts. Some of them are pro, and some of them are, they're critical of the material that Joseph Smith had back in those days. And Joseph Smith gets put under kind of a test, in a sense, where if he's a translator, how's he learning this Egyptian, this kind of, and they don't take into account this revelatory seership that Joseph Smith had as a prophet. And so he gets both critics and he gets both the supporters, I guess, if you want to put it that way, with this papyri. But we don't know what happened to the Joseph roll. We don't know if he did anything with that. We know that he showed the papyri to people, mm-hmm. and some were, you know, impressed, and some were, you know, not
skeptical
yeah. about it. And so, but it was shown a lot back in those days. Even from the time in Kirtland period, it was shown to people, and there's records of that all the way up into the Nauvoo period, all the way up until the time the prophet was killed. Even afterwards, with Lucy, we know that people are looking at it, and they're making comments about it. Some are constructive and very helpful. Mm-hmm. Some are, you know, very skeptical and not.
Joseph's translation of what we today call the Book of Abraham shows up, as you pointed out, in the Times and Seasons, which is
That's right.
was the Nauvoo period equivalent of our church news or Ensign.
That's right.
The official publication of the church that way. So how do we get from Times and Seasons being published to what we have today in what we call the Pearl of Great Price?
Well, we should all be thankful to Franklin D. Richards. He was in England late 1840s, early 1850s as a mission president. And he was a pack rat. We're grateful to him for that because he kept all of the issues of the Times and Seasons. He kept all that. And as you know, we lost some of that mm-hmm. through the printing presses and those mm-hmm. kinds of things that were burned up. And the saints in Britain were hungry for any of the revelations that Joseph Smith had. And of course, over here, we're having paper problems over here. We're over in the Rocky Mountain region in the desert. We're just starting to plant trees. We don't really have any help as far as that goes. And of course, they have tons of publishing abilities over there in Britain. And so he decides that he's going to put this material together, and he creates the very first Pearl of Great Price. There's a lot of Doctrine and Covenants in it. There's the Book of Moses in it. There's the Book of Abraham, Joseph Smith, Matthew, all kinds of material that he felt the saints could appreciate. And his main reason, he wanted to show the prophetic stature of the prophet Joseph Smith, and that he was a true prophet of God. And then he writes that right in his preface to that edition. It's called the 1851 edition of the Pearl of Great Price. And later on, it gets reprinted and reprinted again. And then in 1878, the first presidency here asks Orson Pratt to go and make an American edition. That suggests that the Americans know about this British edition, this 1851 edition. Well, of course, you know, you've got missionaries going back and forth and immigrants and all this kind of stuff. And so the 1851 edition is getting a lot of exposure. So Orson Pratt goes through and he creates the American version and cuts out some of the DNC because it was mostly procedural type things and kind of gets it a little closer to the way it is today. And then in 2 years later, in General Conference, October of 1880, it's canonized as a part of our standard works. And then it just goes through a few changes after that under James E. Talmage, who put it in columns and verses and those to make it look exactly like it does today. And so that's kind of a general survey, that I guess, of the history of that.
Interesting. And so we get the printed version that was coming out in issues or segments, if you will, now. Because it was given to the British saints and as almost like a missionary tract and a strengthening the branches tract, we now bring it into a canonized volume of Scripture.
Marvelous process, isn't it?
Great story. Great, amazing history of how we get that volume of Scripture. You're listening to Past Impressions on the Mormon Channel. We're talking today with Professor Brian Hauglett of the Department of Ancient Scripture at Brigham Young University about the Book of Abraham. We've talked about the history of the papyri and the translation process. We've talked about how it was preserved and published for the saints. Why don't we talk now, Brian, about specifically what is the doctrinal contribution of this Book of Abraham, both to those early saints in Nauvoo, but particularly after 1880, when we have the canonized Scripture Book of Abraham. What is so important about this book?
Well, one of my most favorite doctrines that gets, I think, restored in the Book of Abraham is priesthood doctrine. the word priesthood is not even mentioned in Genesis, not even once. And yet it's multiple times in the book of Abraham.
That Abraham's seeking the blessings of the fathers, and it's clear that he wants the priesthood and the blessings of the priesthood.
That's right. That's exactly right. And of course, you get the relationship of the priesthood to the Abrahamic covenant coming out so much more clearly in the book of Abraham than you do in any of our other scriptures. It ties it directly to the book of Abrahamic covenant, as you know. Mm-hmm. And so you have, you know, priesthood just being taught so much more clearly and profoundly there. Also, we have premortality. Mm-hmm. There's Abraham, you know, thou art one of the great and noble ones there. We have foreordination.
Which is a doctrine that has been lost on the Judeo-Christian world completely.
That's right.
And I mean, this is huge. I mean, we as Latter-day Saints take for granted our belief in a premortal existence, but this was revolutionary.
That's right.
This is huge that Joseph, under inspiration and from Abraham, that we recognize that we were intelligences before we ever came to this earth.
That's right.
This is a huge doctrinal restoration.
Yeah, and when you get into chapter 3, when you start talking about intelligences and being compared to Kolob and, mm-hmm. and planets and stars and these kinds of things, and then you've got these intelligences that were, you know, that gets into a whole nother thing there that none of our other scriptures even triggers
right.
talking about.
Well, in fact, it's the only place in all of the standard works where the word shows up other than in the Doctrine and Covenants when it speaks of intelligence singular.
That's right.
And it's clear that the book of Abraham and the revelation there is causing Joseph to ponder on the immortality of the soul and the mind of man, the soul of man, the intelligence of man.
And it's interesting that actually started some discussions earlier on. You know, well, what are intelligences? What
exactly.
is this intelligence stuff that we're talking about? Joseph Smith said, this is eternal, but what's eternal?
Yeah.
What do we mean by that?
Well, he'd gotten the revelation in section 93
that's
in
right.
Kirtland, so he's already familiar a little bit with the concept that there's something that's eternal. And then certainly the book of Abraham brings even more to the forefront.
Well, it brings in the idea that, I mean, if you're talking about intelligence in DNC 93, is that the same thing as intelligences
exactly. no,
in Abraham 3?
And that's certainly interesting what the prophet Joseph talks about in the King Follett
that's
Discourse.
Right. And we're not given much information
no,
as to that phase of our existence, that intelligence phase. You know, we know that there was a spirit birth. We know that there's mortality. We know there's post-mortality.
What other do you see unique doctrines that we don't find in the Genesis account, and particularly, and you're a scholar on Abraham, what particularly do we see about the life of Abraham that is unique?
Yeah. The doctrines, I think if you look at the book of Abraham and you were to just kind of list out doctrines, I mean, you can do the doctrine of, for instance, premortality actually has extensions to it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so when the Lord is teaching Abraham, and he's teaching him these things in Abraham 3, by the way, if you look at, I think it's verse 12, so that you can declare these things unto the Egyptians. And he starts with all this astronomy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then the doctrines that he attaches to that physical reality, where you've got the hierarchy of the way things were, the governing Kolob, the governing planets. And then he applies that to the spirits. Well, there's obviously going to be governing spirits. There's going to be one great spirit that maybe is
more intelligent than all the others.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of equating that to Kolob or whatever. And it's so interesting to me to see that coming out there. Now, as far as the life of Abraham goes, we have more on the life of Abraham than we do in the early life of Abraham. Let's put it that way, because it actually picks up in Genesis 12. But chapter 1 isn't in Genesis. Mm-hmm. It's not in Genesis at all. We have nothing in Genesis about Abraham almost being killed on an altar. Mm-hmm. We don't know anything about the daughters of Oneida. We don't know anything about the discovery of Egypt, except for what you see in chapter 1. They're not talked about at all in the Genesis account.
And how in the world does Joseph Smith just, if you don't allow for revelation, how in the world would Joseph know anything about the world of Abraham?
He would not. In fact, one of the exciting things about the book of Abraham is that it actually puts Ur, okay, Ur of the Chaldees, up in the north.
Yeah.
Up in southern Turkey, as opposed down in southern Mesopotamia.
And the geography matters a great deal.
It does.
I mean, I've had the privilege of being in those places, and it makes sense.
That's right. I mean, the book of Abraham says clearly that there's Egyptian influence in Ur of the Chaldees, whereas down in the Mesopotamian one, there's no Egyptian influence down there. And so the book of Abraham actually clears up a scholarly discussion there.
Interesting.
And so to me, that's fascinating.
What have you gained personally from your study of the book of Abraham? If you were to just put it in a nutshell, how has your life personally been blessed by your study of the book of Abraham?
I think for me, when I read the book of Abraham, it's the voice of God speaking to me, just as much as the Book of Mormon or DNC or any of our other standard works. And the book of Abraham, to me, has helped me understand more about priesthood, more about the Abrahamic covenant than I could ever learn anywhere else, I think. And that's been a great blessing for me. And it's helped me know that I have somewhere that I came from, that I was maybe chosen before I was born, that there's maybe we were among that council
and great ones.
Exactly. We were there, and we experienced that with them. That's what that means something to me.
Wow. Thank you. Professor Brian Hauglett of the Department of Ancient Scripture at Brigham Young University, we are so grateful for your contribution, your scholarship on the Book of Abraham. We are fascinated by its history, its origins, but also blessed by how that great volume of Scripture blesses our lives today. Join us again in the future as we study the history, the people, places, events, and critical issues associated with the history of the restored gospel of Jesus Christ and the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Brent Topp, your host, and saying farewell for another episode of Past Impressions.